This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we bring you an encore interview with economist Max Wolf on the deepening economic crisis.
Once upon a time, law controlled excess capitalism. It doesn't any longer, and we're paying the price.
We'll also hear a speech from the recent symposium called Preventing Torture, with a focus on extraordinary rendition. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
As all of us are aware, the American economy is in the tank and has been for some months and looks like it's going further. How did it get there and where is it going? Those are the questions we're going to discuss with Max Fraud Wolf, who's an instructor at the graduate program in International Affairs at the New School University here in New York City. Max is a freelance researcher, strategist, and a writer in the areas of international finance and macroeconomics. His work can be seen at the Huffington Post, the Asia Times, Prudent Bear, and many other outlets. Max, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've seen in the last period, and particularly in the last couple of weeks, utter economic disaster approaching. We've already had 500,000 people lose their homes. They're officially talking now about a recession. You've had Bush come in and take out Bear Stearns. This venerated old Wall Street banking company no longer exists. What's going on? Is this some kind of a crisis that the policies of neoliberalism have finally brought to bear on us? What's your take on things, Max?
There's certainly no way to begin to discuss this crisis that doesn't absolutely have to include a discussion of the neoliberal paradigm and deregulation, particularly in financial markets, because that's where this latest round of trouble emerged. But actually, this trouble has been building as a structural portion of the economy for the better part of 30 years, aggravated and made worse, made bigger, made more international by the deregulation of financial markets and by the sheer amount of speculative leverage or debt or borrowing in those markets.
As our listeners know, we're a legal program, and you use the word deregulation. What does that mean to a person like me sitting out there who doesn't really understand what's regulated, what's deregulated, what laws were taken away in deregulation?
Sure, that's the $64,000 question, and I think it's going to be the jurisprudential question and the legislative question as the dust begins to settle from a fire that's still raging, so we don't know how much it'll burn of the economic infrastructure here. But basically, starting in the 80s, at a very aggravated pace, very rapid pace, we began to remove the shackles and limitations from what investment banks, broker-dealers, the people in the stock and bond markets, could do in terms of other banking, and to unshackle slowly the money center banks, the basic commercial and retail banking. And so we had a 20 to 25-year run in which all activities financial were removed from their sort of cages or boxes they were placed in as a reaction to the fallout of the Great Depression.
So in other words, after the Great Depression, they didn't just want a completely unregulated financial market. They started to put banks in one kind of box, investment banks in another, and put restrictions on them. And you're saying in the last 25 years, they've taken off those restrictions.
Yeah, more and more of what only certain kind of banks could do in their own market, and they can't. In other words, each was in their own box and they couldn't traverse into other boxes. More and more of these walls were lifted up and thrown away. And so more and more financial institutions, more and more kind of intermediaries, they're called, between savers and lenders and such, got into financial markets. More and more financial market firms got into commercial lending and retail lending, and also insurance companies and mutual fund companies. And then we allowed and facilitated the extremely rapid development of the totally unregulated space in financial markets, which came to be so large that it actually exists outside the purview of any of our standard regulatory bodies, outside the SEC.
What do you mean? I don't understand that.
There's a lot of financial vehicles or activities that no longer have any reporting duty whatsoever or restriction on what they hold, how much borrowing they do, and in fact, how they operate.
That's like a hedge fund would be like
that. A hedge fund is totally outside the regulated space. I mean, there are some regulations on activities, but there's no regulatory body that oversees hedge funds. And because of a large lawsuit, sort of famous lawsuit about 18 months ago, they don't even have to acknowledge their existence to any particular regulatory body. There's all kinds of specialty vehicles and what are called off-balance sheet vehicles and partnerships that likewise exist outside of the direct regulatory oversight of any particular federal, state, or local agency. They have regulations on their activities, but not on their institutional existence as an entity.
Now, as a dummy sitting here, what that sounds to me like, what if I look back on the few years, having this whole unregulated industry, obviously a lot of money to go into all kinds of things, which maybe helped boost our economy, but why all of a sudden is all that unregulated money causing us a problem?
Well, because when people have a lot of faith and when the tides are rising, all kinds of unregulated risky vehicles seem like a good risk. You trust the system. You trust that prices go up over time, whether that's the price of houses or the price of exotic financial vehicles or the prices of shares. And so long as you think that things are moving in your direction and you have a pretty deep-seated faith in the idea that these things are market-tested, so the efficiency of the market has signed off on them by virtue of their existence, and you think that rising tides lift all boats, you can buy any boat in the harbor. Right. And the boats that seem riskiest should rise the fastest. And if that keeps being true for year in and year out, the pessimists, the worrywarts, the chicken littles lose money and they either go under or they get aggressive. And so you have this sort of adverse selection process where the biggest risk takers get the biggest rewards and the most skeptical, worried folks get the smallest rewards and are either destroyed by having too low returns and losing clients or drink the Kool-Aid and end up with religion. And so long as enough people believe something is heading in one direction, then you have some momentum in that direction. All speculative market prophecies are self-fulfilling.
Well, Max, let me ask you this. Over the last period, we've seen a real reduction in the strength of trade unions. We've seen real wages frozen for some 30 years. We've seen welfare smashed under Clinton. All these ways the society used to function after the Great Depression, the neoliberals tried to take away. And now we're standing at the beginning of what seems to me to be an unrolling huge financial crisis. Can you try to tie those together for us?
Sure. I mean, part of what we did is in order to have the biggest, brassiest international boom, we removed the restrictions on our economy, on our market system, on our corporations, and on our banking system. I would make the analogy that's a little bit like you want to enjoy a beautiful afternoon, and it's been beautiful weather for weeks, and you live in a place where it's nice out a lot, and you decide to really make your house a winner, you cut the roof off. And it's amazing. It's almost as though you had a 50-foot ceiling or a million-foot ceiling. It's absolutely wonderful. Although you have a problem. If it rains sooner or later, you know, this is not going to go so well. So in other words, in order to have the biggest, most international, brassiest, brashest boom ever, we removed all the fetters, all the restrictions that cap the upside and cap the downside. All the things we had done to smooth the business cycle, which were mostly political, actually, compromises with the general public and various regulatory agencies in the government, we removed those to have the biggest, wildest upside
boom. Now, who's responsible for that? Democrats, Republicans, everybody?
I mean, it's hard to apportion exactly. Surely the Republican Party has gotten a lot of the benefit of announcing itself as the party that champions this. So one would expect them to possibly reap the downside risk as well, now that this looks like less of a grand idea, although many Democrats have been associated with it as well. It's mostly the sort of free market, private enterprise, market fundamentalists who have most associated with this, the people who are pretty sure that anything done by a state is done badly or done wrong, and anything done by a market is done efficiently, profitably, and right.
So this is really free market to the excess, yeah, much more than almost any country in the world, I guess.
Yeah, large structural recessions tend to be intellectual turning points in the economics profession and tend to show up in legislation. So if the 70s, the late 60s to early 70s global economic slowdown discredited in many minds the Keynesian sort of social welfare state model and created an opening to the neoliberal free marketeers to say the problem is the state, the solution is the marketplace, and the way to grease the track toward profit and happiness and returns and growth is to deregulate all these follies that we've made, these government interventions, these tax and redistribution programs, which are nothing but heavy weights on our real engine as a society, which is private for-profit enterprise.
Now, are any candidates addressing this issue now in saying, well, we have to re-regulate the market, we can't have just an open, you know, brutal free market? Anybody talking about this in any real way to you?
I mean, Denis Kucinich had obviously he's already left the race.
Right.
He does make some mention of these things and probably is deserving of some credit, and did actually even before the crisis, which I think you'd have to give someone more credit for. He's been doing that 2000, 2004.
Right.
So even before the – because it's kind of easy to tell something's wrong when your head's on fire, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a better social return to those people who kind of notice that you're oiling the top of your head with a lot of gasoline, right? That's who saves you if you listen to him. But of the big three in the presidential cycle, McCain, Obama, or Clinton, absolutely not. And in fact, Obama's done well in part by showing that he's even more free market than Clinton. And he's gotten some support, at least in Wall Street, he's much more popular than her. She's not popular.
I've noticed that also. And he has an advisor, actually, from the free market school at University of Chicago. Is that
yeah,
right?
He has a really hardcore kind of – Goolsbee, who's a smart, interesting economist who's done –
Goolsbee
some,
is the
yeah,
guy's
Goolsbee,
name.
Yeah, Goolsbee, yeah, has done some interesting work, would be as much of a free market, right of center economist as you've ever seen in any Republican advisory panel either. I mean, he wouldn't just be on the fringe for the Democrat Party. He would be on the fringe for the Republican Party as well.
Max Frodwolf, an economist, he's here with us in the studio. Max, give us your impression of where we're at today and where things are likely to go.
Okay, well, I mean, where we're at is also interesting in New York City, because New York, I think a lot of people in New York have a less than accurate assumptions about the way the national economy is going, because the turn down here was late to arrive, because New York City real estate and New York City retail and New York City as an experience, an international experience, is busy being bought up on the cheap because of our devalued dollar by foreign nationals, and that creates an artificial boost to New York City. In addition to which, New York City has increasingly become an economy run on wealth, not income from labor. And wealth has done much better than income from labor for a long time.
When you say that, what you mean is we make our money off of investment banks and stocks and
absolutely
all that kind of stuff rather than labor, people who have these big stock funds here and everything like that.
And we're a city of trust fund kids and right. parental support. I mean, there's an awful lot of people in this city working for $40,000 a year and living in an apartment where the rent is $39,000 a year. And you don't have to be obsessed with mathematics and economics to figure out that some family or other wealth is supporting their lifestyle. So in the big picture, sure, we're a city that pushes paper wealth transactions, speculates, and provides all sorts of luxury services to the wealthy. And I think a lot of people living here are living off past accrued wealth of one kind or another. And quite honestly, they sort of have to be because the price structure in New York is such that even the average job in the five boroughs would not buy you even lower middle class living standards in Manhattan and increasingly in the more popular areas of Queens, Brooklyn, et cetera.
Where do you think we're at today, generally, not just New York, and then where do you think we're going?
I think we are in the early stages of a probably minimum 1.5 to 2 year recession, best case scenario, which will be deeper than we've seen at least since the 80s, and looks like it will structurally shift the position of the United States in the global economy. We're going to see fire sales. In other words, we're going to see foreign pools of wealth and foreign companies cherry picking desirable American assets on the cheap, and we're going to see some significant long-term stress to the economy here. I mean, we're going to see unemployment will definitely, I would forecast, will be above 5.5%. So it'll be up significantly by the end of the year, would be my guess. You'll see a lot of mass layoffs. And then probably the bigger question is, how do we respond to it? Historically, the United States likes one of two roads, popular among developed countries, to get out of a recession, which is inflation your way out of it or war your way out of it. And part of the reason that the bind is difficult now is because we have two wars going and an inflation already. So using inflation or war to get out of it is tricky when you're presently
fighting.
When
you say using inflation, as my understanding as a layperson, you simply print more money and feed it into the economy as a way of giving people more money. That's inflation.
Yeah.
And war is just spending more money, also inflationary, because you're printing more money to fight the war.
Yeah, if you have a huge structural debt problem, and the United States does, and we net borrow $1.5 billion a day from the rest of the world, so we owe a lot of money. An easy way to pay it back on some level, if you don't lose control of the game, is to devalue the currency so the value of the dollars you need to pay back is lower and therefore more manageable. That would also help indebted homeowners and it might help in a very indebted central government. People have a tendency to forget, but you know the $8 trillion or so that the government's in debt here is an issue as well, the federal government. So you try to devalue the money and you do that in a bunch of ways, one of which is overprinting money. And the idea there being with a fixed quantity of goods and services to buy, if you pump more money into people's hands, you have more money chasing no more goods and services, and that extra money bids up the price of the goods and services in a kind of social version of what would happen at the Sotheby's auction house. If a lot of people with the means to purchase an object on auction show up, all things being equal, you know, ceteris paribus, so this is the Latin assumption that we like in economics, it should put an upward steady pressure on the price. And so,
but as you said, we're already in inflationary and we're already fighting two wars.
Yeah.
So what does that tell you could happen to get us out of this recession in the next couple of years?
Well, it tells you that there's a more of a significant risk that you get stuck in a recession for a protracted period of time, a la Japan in the 1990s, or the Depression here, which did last about 12 years. I mean, so we have had longer recessions. But it means that our traditional methods of fighting recession have already been in use more or less to cover up and make less structurally difficult the last recession of 2001, and that the sort of popular easy options of stoking the money supply to create the inflation to bail yourself out, or distracting and unifying the public with a war and the extra spending that comes with a war, which is the only kind of government spending that the American right traditionally will vote for. Those are a little bit less of options because we're already spending $1 trillion on Afghanistan and Iraq, and we don't really have the money for it. And we already have an inflation rate much higher than the official numbers suggest, and high enough that it's already a structural problem. We only really see it in certain areas, but you see it in energy and fuel costs and food costs. And I would also say that this U.S. recession has already tripped across the containment barrier, so it's already fast becoming a global phenomenon.
What laws, if you were to redo it, I mean, apart from some form of socialism, but in a capitalist society like ours, free market, what kind of laws would you want to see people advocating for to prevent this kind of recession happening in the future?
Well, I think that there's a bit of an issue. You don't want to make such a delay on the new and innovative financial products that they can't come around and serve the market needs. But I do think that having totally unregulated production of these products with no oversight was never a good idea, and that's been sort of borne out. So I think you need to have a registration. I think there needs to be a burden that regulators and purchasers of new and exotic products have to be given a basic understanding of what it is they're buying with a highly neutral outside auditor, and that has to be done on an ongoing basis so that this endless black box mystery meat sales machine that Wall Street set up cannot be allowed to occur. Not because there might not be a lot of great innovative products in there, there are, but because the chance for all kinds of suspicious activity and the chance for people buying a lot that they don't know what the hell they're buying is a problem. I mean, I think Wall Street really grew and got out of control for another reason, though, which is worth mentioning, which is the structural upswing in Wall Street has to do with deregulation and upward wealth redistribution. And so long as our economy is reducing regulations that hem in these positions and redistributing wealth to the people who like to play in the stock market, you're going to have these kind of bubbles. What became bizarre here, and what is the bigger law that I would do, is I don't think people should really be allowed to speculate on their homes. And turning private houses into debt vehicles and financial speculation vehicles was a really poor idea, based on a longstanding American delusion that homes are a good investment and are some kind of a speculative product. They're not. They're a good way to not rent. They might be convenient and wonderful in a lot of ways. And they're a nice safety valve to borrow against in a crisis and help.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way that I've understood this, I know it can be a complicated explanation, is they've essentially taken a house and turned it into a security or a piece of stock that people buy and sell in the market. And then when the time came and prices dropped or something, or they couldn't get out of those houses, that the whole market just went.
Yeah, 10% of the American 10% of America's homeowners are underwater. In other words, they already owe more than their house is worth. And that's before house prices are done falling and before the recession has fully arrived in the employment numbers and other places. So this is not going to be pretty. And what was securitized or turned into a security asset was actually their mortgage.
Right.
And the mismatch between borrowing and owning was not understood by the public either. So I obviously think that the role of these products should have never come to this prominence or importance. That was a weird way of trying to speculate and borrow your way out of stagnant wages, missing or inadequate benefits, missing or inadequate pensions, and missing or inadequate medical care. And had we fixed those problems, even the same speculative bubble that we had, which, by the way, they had in Ireland and they had in Spain and they had in Australia, they had in other places, it wouldn't have had such a decimating impact.
Let me see if I understand. You're saying people borrowed more money on their houses so that they could pay for basic benefits that they couldn't, that the state wasn't providing. Is that?
In a significant portion. People borrow for all kinds of things.
Right.
But I mean, there's a lot of borrowing to make up for inadequate wages and benefits.
The classic problem of capitalism, as I understand it, is the crisis created by the fact that what workers produce and what workers buy are two different things. They're not paid enough to buy back what they produce, and that there's a tendency for overproduction, which leads to cycles and crisis. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a insufficient aggregate demand problem is constant, and it shows up in recession.
So here's my question. It seems to me that this economy was limping along. First, workers haven't been given a real wage, really, for about 35 years, but more people are working longer hours. Both men and women or children in the household are working to keep up with things. You had the dot-com bubble for a while. You had people borrowing money on credit cards for a while. I mean, all these things were happening to kind of keep it limping along. And is there something that they can always do to pull the rabbit out of the hat and keep it limping along? Or isn't there coming a time when a crisis here could coincide with a crisis around the world and we'd really be in terrible trouble?
Sure.
And then the kind of laws that we've been talking about, these repressive laws that have come in since 9/11, might be used against us if we try some kind of big social struggles?
Absolutely. They absolutely will be used. They were a prophylactic measure. In other words, they were in there in case you needed them, because there hasn't been a whole lot of organized social misbehavior in this country in a long time. So they're obviously prophylactic. I mean, they're a protective measure. I'm not commenting on birth control here. I realize maybe it's not a term that's widely used. But in any case, that's certainly a possibility. But I would be a little careful about limping along. Segments of the U.S. economy have been galloping to global dominance, and large portions of the American middle class have been sinking deeper and deeper into a quagmire, which is in fact no more remarkable than if you drink 3 gallons of water, eventually having to take a leak. In other words, since the 1970s, we've systematically torn down the institutional underpinnings that created the American middle class. And then we're all shocked to learn that when you destroy all the basic institutional pillars that produced a middle class, an accident of history, the middle class starts going away too. But nobody wants to admit that. Nobody wants to face what that means economically here. And nobody wants to lose their middle class market. So an endless series of social alterations and imbalances arise, buying cheaper and cheaper stuff from lower and lower wage good countries, sending everyone in the house out to work, keeping everybody working into older age, starting them working at younger ages, learning how exciting it is to have a special secret online business selling the crap out of your garage on eBay, borrowing everything you can on every credit card you can get.
These are all ways of keeping a middle class, is what you're saying.
When there's no basic structural underpinning for a middle class. And the really dangerous, interesting thing about a long, serious recession, now a distinct possibility, is what do we do politically and economically, we America, confronted with the fact that our middle class has been dead man walking for 20 years, and it's getting harder and harder to sweep that under the rug.
What made it dead man walking, though? What was the – when you said institutional protections were gone – how would you say what made it dead man walking that required the Walmarts of the world to exist to keep the middle class floating?
Well, international competition, while in many ways a good thing, exposed American workers, right, to wage competition with other parts of the world where wages just tended to be lower, which was certainly a problem. And I'd say much bigger than that, which gets less attention than it should, is technological innovation. So you have 30 or 40 years of basically executive-led technological innovation designed to de-skill and remove the power of labor in the production process. And I mean, easy example of that would be what happened to the longshoremen with modern containerized shipping. So you have technology designed to reduce the labor cost and de-skill it and universalize it, which tips the balance between capital and labor when you're negotiating over wages. So the technology is a big portion. International deregulation and trade is a big portion of the story. Where we once had a tax structure that systematically distributed wealth from wealthier people to lower income people, at best, we have a neutral tax structure now. And I would argue probably in many ways, we have a tax structure that actively redistributes wealth upward. Okay, and that doesn't do much for the middle class. The family wage is gone. And when you pull the social safety net, you flood the labor market with lots of desperate people. So each cut to the social safety net decimates all wage labor more or less because there are more people with less and fewer alternative options competing for each job. And that doesn't do much to keep wage levels up either.
Max, thank you very much for
being
on.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We want you back again. We're going to need some frequent updates, I think, on the economic situation, given what you've had to teach us.
If you want them, I write them once a week for the Huffington Post and increasingly for Seeking Alpha, although those are maybe a little tactical. But the Huffington Post is.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. This is Heidi Boghossian of Law and Disorder, inviting you to a dialogue between best-selling author Walter Mosley and TV star Mike Farrell. They'll discuss human rights, American politics, and their new books. Sponsored by the Center for Constitutional Rights, The Nation, and Akashic Books, it will be held at the Strand Bookstore, 828 Broadway at 12th Street, on Tuesday, May 27th at 7 p.m. For more information, go to strandbooks.com. now to hear an excerpt from a speech by Margaret Satterwhite on secret detention and extraordinary rendition at the New York City Law Review Symposium titled Preventing Torture. Margaret is the Assistant Professor of Clinical Law and Faculty Director of the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice at the New York University School of Law. Her current research focuses on human rights in the so-called War on Terror. She directs the Black Sites Litigation Project at NYU, and her recent publications include Rendered Meaningless, Extraordinary Rendition and the Rule of Law. Margaret is also co-chair of the Human Rights Interest Group and the American Society of International Law. Margaret's speech was part of a panel titled Protected Contexts, a look at how states, acting through private entities, assist rendition, and also obligations of the state to intervene to prevent private violence and torture. She was among several speakers whom we will be presenting in the weeks to come. Let's have a listen.
Thank you very much, Professor Kalin. You have presented us with a very thought-provoking address and raised issues that I think are going to be with us for a while, issues of, as you say, the link between jurisdiction and extraterritoriality. I don't want to spend a lot of time, and I'd like to just quickly call on Maggie Satterthwaite to continue on another element of this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to start with a thank you and an apology. The thank you is for the invitation to be here today. I'd like to thank the CUNY Law School, the New York City Law Review, and also, of course, the City Bar, the Human Rights Committee. And the apology is that some of what I say is actually going to overlap with Professor Kalin. I was asked to talk about extraordinary rendition, and a lot of the arguments that the U.S. has made to justify that have to do with the extraterritorial or non-extraterritorial application of human rights law in the U.S.'s opinion. So I will try to summarize those sections that overlap. I'm going to start by just talking a little bit about what extraordinary rendition is. Shortly after the attacks of 9/11, President George Bush gave the CIA authorization to set up a secret program aimed at taking terrorism suspects off the street. The resulting extraordinary rendition and secret detention program, which I'll just refer to here as the program, reportedly involves the covert approval of kill, capture, or detain orders for specified individuals. As the name implied, these KCD orders appear to allow U.S. agents, secretly and without warning to those targeted, to apprehend, imprison, and even target for death those individuals who are determined to be eligible for the program. What this has meant in practice is that certain individuals are apprehended and transferred to the custody of foreign governments for coercive interrogation. Others are apprehended and sent to secret prisons or so-called CIA black sites. And others may have been summarily killed. It's harder to link the KCD order to specific targeted killings, but we know that the U.S. has used targeted killings in the so-called war on terror. The U.S. government has not released comprehensive information about the program. Still unknown are the exact number and identities of people subject to KCD orders, the numbers and identities of people rendered to third countries for interrogation, the number and identities of individuals held in secret CIA black sites, and the number being killed through operation of a KCD order. And all of those questions actually are the subject of two different lawsuits right now, one of which was brought by my clinic in conjunction with the Center for Constitutional Rights and Amnesty International, just seeking literally the names, identities, and the numbers involved in this program. Concerning transfers to foreign governments, the estimates range from about 100 to several thousand. The best guess for black sites is that about 36 to 100 individuals have been held in such facilities, and the number of people who have been summarily killed is unknown. Despite the secrecy, what we know about the program, we largely know through the stories of those who have emerged from it. We know about extraordinary rendition through the case of Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen wrongly identified as an Al-Qaeda member and transferred from New York to Syria, where he was detained and tortured for about a year before being released. We know about the secret detention program through Khaled al-Masri, a German citizen who was wrongly accused of being an al-Qaeda member, abducted in Macedonia, and sent to a secret CIA prison in Afghanistan, where he was held for 5 months and subjected to coercive interrogation. In contrast with the government's attempts to keep that information secret, it has not been secret about its legal arguments and justifications for the program. In fact, the U.S. government has actively made a series of legal arguments aimed at justifying the program. Although those who defend the program do not explicitly support the use of informal transfer to a risk of torture, prolonged incommunicado detention, or targeted killings, defenders of the program imply that it is legal by pointing to what they claim are lacuna or gaps in the relevant legal framework. The administration suggests that where such lacunae are found, prohibitions give way to permission. Territories outside the United States are conceptualized as locations where the U.S. may act as it pleases. Informal promises between countries, diplomatic assurances, replace the absolute prohibition on certain transfers, and the war paradigm is used to deprive individuals of the protection of the law. I won't attempt to explore all of these arguments in my brief comments today. Instead, I will focus on the very significant contributions that General Comment Number 2 makes to closing these loopholes and to closing down the gaps that the U.S. has tried to claim and exploit. And I'm going to focus on the most well-known elements of the program, extraordinary rendition, secret detention. Although there's been vigorous debate within the United States about the legality of the Extraordinary Rendition Secret Detention Program, intergovernmental organizations such as the Council of Europe, the European Parliament, and international human rights bodies, including the Human Rights Committee and the Committee Against Torture, have stated unequivocally that the program contravenes international human rights law binding on the United States. The relevant human rights norms protecting against extraordinary rendition and secret detention include the following, but certainly are not limited to the following. The prohibition on refoulement, which prescribes transfers to a risk of torture. The prohibition of enforced disappearances, which prescribes a concealment of the fate and whereabouts of individuals deprived of their liberty. And the norm against torture and cruel and human degrading treatment. So I'll briefly just refer to what each of those norms are and why they prohibit the program. So the prohibition of refoulement is set out in a wide variety of human rights instruments, and of course most relevant today is Article 3 of CAT, which prohibits the transfer of individuals to states where they may be in danger of torture. And the article has been interpreted to apply to all forms of transfer. So it's not only extradition or deportation, but it's also informal transfers, any kind of transfer from one state to another. When extraordinary rendition involves transfer to a country where an individual is at a real risk of torture or cruel and human and degrading treatment, that transfer then is prohibited by binding international human rights law. Transfers to secret detention are likewise prohibited, in part because prolonged incommunicado detention, like that which detainees experience in CIA black sites, has itself been found to constitute, at minimum, cruel and human and degrading treatment, and often, especially when combined with coercive interrogation techniques, to torture. Indeed, those who have emerged from the program, and I've talked to a number of them, stress that the prolonged incommunicado detention, being in solitary confinement with no sense of where you are even, why you're there, and when you might be released, is the most profound experience of torture in their experience in relation to even the course of techniques they may have experienced. In addition, there's no doubt that secret detention is in itself unlawful under human rights law. The UN Committee Against Torture has found that secret detention is a per se violation of the Torture Convention. When carried out in the manner used in the program, secret detention amounts to enforced disappearance. The U.S. government has focused a great deal of energy in the last several years on efforts to carve out a legal space for action in the war on terror. Instead of simply acting as a scofflaw, then, the U.S. has systematically produced these legal arguments. In relation to extraordinary rendition and secret detention, the strategy has been to clear a space that's free of legal constraint. General Comment 2 speaks directly to several of the main arguments, and the first is the one regarding extraterritoriality. As Professor Kalin mentioned, the U.S. has repeatedly said in its arguments and in its reports to the international treaty monitoring bodies that the U.S. is not bound when it acts outside of its own territory by human rights conventions. In other words, the U.S. is saying if you're outside the U.S. but you're actually held by the U.S., you're out of luck and you're not protected by human rights norms. General Comment 2 reaffirms the broad scope of application of the Torture Convention by affirming that the phrase any territory under its jurisdiction, which is used in a number of key provisions in CAP but not all of them, refers to any territory, facility, or person under the de jure or de facto control of a state party. The U.S. argument that non-refoulement does not apply outside of its territory was always unconvincing, in fact, because Article 3 is one of the articles that doesn't have a territorial scope element in it at all. Instead, here what you have with General Comment 2 is a closing of the gap between articles that appear on their face to apply no matter where someone is and those that appear to only apply within the territory of a state. And the purpose, obviously, behind that and the principle behind it is the principle of prevention. Now that the committee has made clear that those articles that do specify a territorial scope of application apply to locations or persons under the effective control of a state party, the U.S. position vis-a-vis Article 3 is even weaker than it was before. It would be absurd to say that even though a U.S. detention facility or on foreign territory is covered by the obligation to prevent cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment, as set out in Article 16, the prohibition of non-refoulement, as set out in Article 3, does not apply to someone the U.S. holds. Indeed, I think that argument now appears to be quite incoherent. The clarification about territoriality is also extremely relevant to the destination for many individuals subject to extraordinary rendition, the so-called CIA black sites, where enhanced interrogation techniques or alternative procedures such as sleep deprivation, sensory manipulation, and waterboarding have been authorized and used. For many years, the United States has interpreted Article 16 to only apply to U.S. territory. This interpretation, while not overly argued, was plainly relied upon by the CIA in designing the enhanced interrogation techniques, which would only be used in black sites far from U.S. territory. Indeed, when the U.S. Supreme Court made clear that Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions applied to those apprehended and detained in connection with the War on Terror, the CIA began to shut down or empty out those CIA black sites. And CIA agents reportedly began to buy personal liability insurance because they were worried that they could be held personally responsible for committing, for using cruel and inhuman grade treatment and torture on individuals abroad. Had the U.S. accepted that Article 16 applied to those facilities from the outset of the War on Terror, which to these techniques, which plainly, as I said, do amount to cruel and inhuman degrading torture, cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment and torture, perhaps this program would not have been approved. Another crucial contribution of General Comment 2 is that it emphasizes the non-derogability of the prohibition on torture, which a number of the speakers have referred to. The general comment underlines that no circumstances whatsoever, including threat of terrorist acts or international or non-international armed conflict, may be invoked to avoid or delay the obligations set out in the convention. And Professor Kalin has already gone into the U.S. argument regarding international law and the war on terror. But what I just want to say, I will skip over most of what I was going to say about that. But one interesting thing about it is the U.S.'s use of the lex specialis doctrine, which Professor Kalin did refer to. In essence, what the U.S. is saying is we are in an armed conflict. It's an armed conflict against unlawful combatants. So what you need to do is look to international humanitarian law to see what the lex specialis is, and that's international humanitarian law. Now, because folks are unprivileged combatants, they actually fall outside of that law, therefore essentially no law applies. That's the basic argument that is being made. And General Comment 2 does a great job of explaining why that is also an incoherent argument. And I'm going to skip through the rest of that. General Comment 2 also calls attention to the fact that individuals accused of terrorist acts are especially at risk of torture. This clarification calls attention to the special vulnerability of detainees accused of terrorist crimes to torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. This vulnerability stems from the abhorrence with which society rightly regards acts of violence that deliberately target civilians. And it is just this rightful abhorrence that should also lead states to interpose safeguards to ensure that even those who society despises are not tortured or subjected to ill treatment. This is crucial to upholding society's values, like international humanitarian law, which is designed exactly to protect detainees who are held by their enemies against the often legitimate anger of their enemy jailers. Measures to prevent ill treatment of terrorism suspects should be systematically implemented. The U.S. has intentionally avoided clarifying that even legitimate anger cannot be expressed as torture and ill treatment. Instead, the U.S. has exploited the anger that the American public has experienced to argue that terrorism suspects are not protected against torture and cruel treatment. These arguments, often in the background of public discourse, have led to the tacit acceptance of policies and practices like those revealed in the Abu Ghraib scandal and discussed in the earlier panel. The general comment reminds us that the prohibition on torture and ill treatment is absolute, and that states must be especially vigilant when dealing with those who their agents may despise. General comment 2 underscores the interdependence between the prevention of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment and the prevention of torture. This clarification is relevant to both extraordinary rendition and secret detention. In relation to extraordinary rendition, emphasizing that obligations to prevent torture and obligations to prevent cruel and inhuman degrading treatment are interdependent, indivisible, and interrelated is crucial to ending rendition. The U.S. government has exploited the distinction between the two in the non-refoulement context by arguing that Article 3 of CAT applies only to torture and not to cruel treatment. This has meant that the U.S. takes a very cramped view of prohibited conduct. It believes that nothing prohibits it from transferring an individual to a risk of ill treatment. The general comment makes plain that the obligation to prevent torture means that states may not transfer individuals to a risk of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment either. The U.S. government continues to argue that its secret program is not prohibited by human rights law. Just a few weeks ago, another individual was transferred to Guantanamo out of CIA custody, demonstrating that the black sites are again still in operation. While even the most brilliantly written general comment may not convince American leaders to reverse course, clear statements of the law do act as a check on the proliferation of such arguments. By clarifying that CAT extends to the extraterritorial actions of ratifying states, that the duty to prevent torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment continues to be in effect even during armed conflict, and that states must actively ensure that those most vulnerable to abuse, including those suspected of terrorist crimes, are protected against torture and ill treatment, General Comment 2 makes a very significant contribution. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Maggie, for advancing our understanding of extraordinary rendition, one of those sensitive practices that we never hear about in ordinary newspapers.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
That's lawanddisorder.org.